the Indiana National Guard not pursuing courts-martial, lawmakers consulting work, plus speed cameras close to reality, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending March 17th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana National Guard leaders have been telling lawmakers they are not able to convene general courts-martial to address serious troop misconduct, including 4 sexual assaults last year. But it now appears they never tried. Guard leaders have said the issue is that the power to convene a court-martial is exclusive to the governor. Adjutant General Dale Lyles testified to that during a hearing on a bill that would give him the power to convene one, too.
Egregious misconduct in the case of sexual assault is not being punished to the fullest extent because of my inability to convene these court-martials.
But the governor can only convene a court-martial if the guard calls on him to do so. A spokesperson for Governor Eric Holcomb says he has never received a call since taking office in 2017. Lisa Wilkin is a veteran and sexual assault survivor who represents the American Legion. She says that information is shocking.
If you're wanting to add the adjutant general to the convening authority, and the reason that you give is because the governor has not been convening court martials, and then the information comes out that you haven't requested any court martials to be convened, that's very concerning.
The guard declined to explain why they didn't call for a court-martial in those 4 sexual assault cases, despite leaders saying such cases absolutely should be handled that way. Why is the guard being so evasive on this issue? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Elise, is this a problem almost entirely of the Guard's own making?
Yes, and I think that's maybe why we should take a pause. I mean, that would be my suggestion, because I think a lot of folks are unclear of why this is happening, what it would mean. When the most consistent answer that's been given for the court-martial piece is potential abuse, which is not evidence-based, which is not data-based. This piece of legislation has brought about way more questions than issues that it fixes, and it seems to have the ire of a lot of different folks, including National Guard's people. So I think it's time to take a pause so that we can figure out what's actually going on here. I think a lot of people are uncomfortable with where it is now.
We talked about this bill a few weeks ago, and there are 2 fundamental parts of it. One is the governor is no longer the exclusive authority to call courts martial. That's also given to the adjutant general. Nobody had a problem with that.
Sure.
The other part that a lot more people were concerned about was this idea of taking away the power of a National Guard member to ask for a court martial in the case of a nonjudicial punishment. Well, now the part that everybody seemed to agree to is also problematic, because the answer is, well, the governor is an impediment to this. Have you asked? No. Why haven't you asked? And we just don't know.
An answer. Yeah, there's a little bit of this going on, you know, who's, you know, finger pointing at each other. I think part of the problem with leaving this unresolved, so they are trying to expand, it seems like, the motivation for this is to expand the authority of the National Guard to resolve and investigate these situations, right? That's great. Then left unresolved because no one's talking to each other, or they're not using the existing authority, and or if they have limited resources, the legislature, I think this legislature would be more than willing to invest in the National Guard to help if they ask for that part of it instead of just the kind of the process changes. The problem with it, but go figure all that out. The problem with all this being left unresolved is that creates a culture that is not helpful either. If people in the Guard, I mean, these guys know what's going on. These guardsmen know what's going on inside their own ranks. And you can't let this linger and create this culture that, oh, left unresolved, nothing happens.
Or
we're going to take away due process, and then we don't have access to that. I mean, there's a lot of layers to
this. I mean, that creates a problem with existing Guard members. It creates a problem with recruiting new Guard members, which I think you can't, you know, in this day and age, you really can't, you shouldn't be doing things to discourage that. Something that has always also struck me, though, to what Mike just talked about, which is on the Senate floor this week, this bill was debated a couple times, on second reading, then on third reading when it passed, and it's now in the governor's desk, and I'm fascinated to see what he does with it, although I'm guessing he'll just sign it. But it was raised that, well, okay, finally, the reason we have to get rid of this due process right, the idea that you can call a court-martial, is because, well, under the current system, anybody will just ask for a court-martial, and we can't do them, and so that ends the process. Like, we can't punish people, even when they need to be punished, because all they have to do is ask for a court-martial, and then they know it'll just go away. Isn't that a more fundamental problem that needs to be solved?
One would think. There are a lot of issues going on here. You look at, if you want to get really broad, it's the challenge of dealing with issues such as sexual assault when you're talking about institutions that have operated largely out of public scrutiny for generations. And I'm talking about all branches of the military. I'm talking about corporations. I'm not singling out the military by any stretch. But, I mean, we see it time and time again, despite the best efforts to police and eliminate these kinds of unwelcome advances and so forth. CNN just this week was looking at Coast Guard enforcement in terms of the Merchant Marine, which they have the enforcement power for allegations of sexual assault on commercial vessels all over the world, and they have done zero in the last decade in that front, even though there have been numerous allegations and seemingly valid allegations. So that's part of this. We just struggle as a society to deal with these things in the right way. And then I think the other thing is, the General Assembly generally is not accustomed to dealing with military issues. I mean, this is, I think, the sort of the instinctive response, not just for lawmakers, but all of us, is, you know, gee, I'm not qualified to weigh in on this. These are professional soldiers. These are the men and women who we entrust with our safety and security. They must know what they should do. And I think it's forcing the General Assembly to exercise muscles that have atrophied, perhaps.
And that gets back to, isn't this a problem of the Guard's own making, the way this has gotten complicated?
I mean, this was handled just terribly. I mean, this might be an issue, but we don't know because there's no data. They haven't told us how many major and minor offenses there are been in recent years. They haven't told us how many non-judicial punishments have been meted out, for what purposes. They haven't said whether anyone's asked for a court-martial. We don't know anything. And it took us almost 3 months to find out that they haven't asked for a court-martial, even from the governor. So I have no doubt it's going to get signed into law, but I think there are a lot of big remaining questions. Essentially, how has the Guard been operating for decades without using court-martials?
Yeah. All right. More than a dozen Indiana lawmakers have consultant jobs, according to a story this week in the Indiana Capital Chronicle, and the rules about disclosing consulting clients don't always provide for much transparency. The Capital Chronicle story identified at least 15 lawmakers who consult for private businesses, including House Speaker Todd Houston, and it notes that more lawmakers have small businesses that could do consulting work. Legislative ethics rules only require lawmakers to list the clients they consult for if they're a significant source of income, meaning some lawmakers do and others don't. The Capital Chronicle story mentions Democratic Representative Blake Johnson, who didn't list his clients on his disclosure form because, according to Johnson, he didn't even think to do so when the form didn't prompt it. Mike O'Brien, we've talked before on the show about the strengths and weaknesses of a citizen legislature, and there's always the idea of a conflict of interest that kind of goes along with that, which is, yes, sometimes I'm passing a bill that will enrich the industry I'm in, and the reason I have that bill is because I know what I'm talking about when it comes to that industry. Does this go a little beyond that problem, though?
Well, I think the advantages are, the advantages are you have an insurance agent informing the legislature on insurance policy. You have a teacher informing the legislature on education policy. Otherwise, you have an insurance agent informing the legislature on education policy and a teacher informing the legislature on insurance policy, and nobody knows what the heck they're doing, right? So sometimes that enriches. It's not even about enrichment. It's about understanding. Right. What are the policy decisions we're making and how do they impact the real world? The legislature largely, and I think almost always, benefits from having people from all walks of life in the legislature where the only thing they're doing in life is not be a lawmaker. There's something that's not the most important thing in their life. There's something else they're doing in the world, and I think that really benefits. But it's also requires disclosure of what it is you're also doing in other parts of life. You know, and I think the consistent theme mostly, I think, in the legislators that were talked about in this article, like Blake Johnson, were like, well, it didn't really even occur to me because I'm filling out this form they asked me to fill out. It never occurred to me to go two layers deeper than that in a format. So it's always worth taking another look at what do we, how much and how deep do we require people to disclose? As a lobbyist, I have to disclose a lot. Yeah. It is a huge burden. If I buy you a hot dog, that hot dog is reported to the Lobby Registration Commission. If I don't report, it's a felony. You know, so we there's a lot of transparency in the system, but it's always worth taking a look at it.
Yeah, we're not. The article doesn't, and I don't think we're talking about wrongdoing here. We're saying, particularly, I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, I'm an insurance agent, I'm a teacher. That's pretty obvious.
It's explicit.
It's very explicit. When we're talking about consulting jobs, oh, I'm a consultant. Who do you consult for? I don't have to tell you. Is that the real problem?
Yeah, and that's what the main takeaway for me was of this piece. And I think, Nikki, it was a great piece. It was great reporting, and it is a textbook example of why we need to be supporting local journalism, because this was a deep dive. It wasn't something, it afforded legislators to talk deeply about why they fill things out this way. It underscored that the form doesn't have certain disclosures. It will probably push public policy in a more transparent direction. And it was all, you know, a way to inform this discussion that we need to have. And I think we do need to have it because we do have a drastically imbalanced legislature, right? We have a supermajority. So there is an opportunity to where these things could be unchecked. Are they? That's not what this article is saying. Could they be? Maybe. So having this conversation is really important, and I'm really thankful for the piece.
So we talked to Todd Houston yesterday about the piece, and he said we always need to be looking at our transparency processes to see if they can be improved, and he pointed to the work of the Ethics Commission. You know, it is a supermajority Republican legislature, but not on the ethics committees. Those are split down the middle, Republican and Democrat, and so is this work that needs to be done?
Yeah, and I honestly think it's a few easy fixes, right? I mean, the whole point is that someone could be pushing a bill or blocking a bill for a client, and you would never know. You know, maybe they paid that person $20,000 for their consulting for the year. I don't know, but we would never know. So it's an easy fix. And I do want to give credit, for instance, to Speaker Houston. One of the reasons when we were looking through all these and we're starting to see these consulting LLCs, we noticed he started his own. Well, he actually put down his own clients. He didn't have to. And in fact, we didn't know they were his clients when you were reading through it because there's no place to put them on the form. So it looked like another business that he had an interest in. So he went out of the way to do that. And some members are doing it and some members aren't.
And in talking to legislative leaders, they made the argument for, you know, that we were also making, which is more transparency, especially on this sort of thing, just makes the system work better, right?
Transparency is always good when you're talking about government's interaction with a democracy. I mean, look back to one of the classic cases at the federal level, Citizens United, where Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, said, this will be great because there's going to be all this transparency. Well, the problem, the reason people are still grousing about that decision and saying it was the worst thing the U.S. Supreme Court ever did is there is no transparency in some of the dark money that flows. So there is a problem. I think lawmakers generally want to do the right thing. They want to disclose it. But it's only the system now is only as good as the people who disclose it. So a year ago, the Capital Chronicle did not exist, heaven forbid. And so had you not created this valuable institution, this entity, we wouldn't know that right now. We wouldn't be having this discussion. So that shows perhaps some fragility in the system.
All right. Well, Indiana is closer than ever to putting speed cameras in a few highway construction zones across the state. A bill to create a pilot program is just a couple steps away from the governor's desk. The pilot would set up cameras in 4 highway work sites. Drivers would be ticketed if they go at least 11 miles per hour over the limit, only when workers are present. And Chad Scott says workers need that protection. Scott has worked in highway construction for nearly 3 decades, and one of his workers was killed a few years ago. Scott told a Senate committee Tuesday that he had to deliver the news to that worker's wife, who was working in another site nearby.
I never want to do that again. Never want to see that again. But that pales in comparison to what Ashley and her 3 boys had to go through from that day.
Road Workers Union leader Brian Short says work zone safety is a recruitment issue, too.
Once we get one of these young kids out there and they have a near miss, they're not coming back.
The bill is headed for the Senate floor. John Schwanitz, we've actually talked about this, I think, a couple times in the last few weeks, the idea of some issues just take a really long time to finally get to the finish line. Is this a perfect example of a measure that needed that time?
This is an issue that wasn't speeding through any construction zone or legislative zone, certainly. And I think that is probably more typical. You know, we see certain issues where there's some big explosion in terms of publicity and outrage and things happen. But I think this is actually, if you... I don't see that anybody's ever charted this, but I'm guessing on these kinds of issues that aren't, quote-unquote, as pressing, you're probably going to have several years. And part of that is because people like to have these worthwhile discussions about, but what if? What if I'm not, somebody's borrowing my car? What if somebody's doing this? What if somebody's doing that? And there are always those sorts of what-if scenarios that need to be worked through. And I think that's what takes time. That and sort of this... You know, there's always going to be that lurking big brother faction that's concerned that any time you put up a camera that isn't, you know, at a prom taking photos of the couples, you're in trouble. Or a wedding, I should say. That's a good thing.
We talked last week about the slippery slope argument as it related to gaming. I think there's a lot of validity to that argument because we've seen it play out. It's also an argument you hear on this issue a lot, which is, listen, a few cameras, I mean, even in the Senate committee this week, a few cameras in highway construction zones to keep workers safe? Yes, absolutely. But my God, we're not going to put cameras at red lights in Indiana. And that's a lot of people's hesitation on this bill. Is that a valid concern? Is that the next step?
It is a valid concern, I guess, because there are lots of ways to use technology, you know, that lawmakers aren't comfortable with. Having said that, let's be honest. This bill does hardly anything now. I mean, four places in the state, you can put some cameras. You have to be going at least 11 over. You don't even get a ticket the first time. It doesn't count against your license. I mean, it really, they've stripped
That's
it so far down. I don't even know that it's going to have an impact. But
what I do think it will have an impact in, and what I'm hoping it will have an impact on, is our overall, I guess, way that we look at infrastructure and keeping people safe, because it's kind of a no-brainer, right, to keep construction workers safe. We also have, and this is part of the larger Vision Zero initiative that people like Senator Hunley are working on, because this is not just about construction workers. We are woefully behind on keeping pedestrians safe, on keeping cyclers safe. So if we can start here, it is a long process. Start here, but have this start to inform the texture of this particular landscape. I think it's a pilot. There's going to be things that we need to look at and study, the cameras, but I think it's a good start, and I hope it opens up more conversation on this.
One thing, too, though, thinking about the long-term future of once we do the pilot program, do we spread it to more sites or even put cameras in different places? Lawmakers have talked for years on this bill about how they or their constituents have complained to them about they got a ticket in the mail from some bridge or some highway somewhere that they've never been. They don't own that car. They don't know. I mean, Randy Fry talked about it. He said, I got a ticket in Maryland this summer from my semi in Maryland. I haven't been to Maryland in 20 years, and I don't own a semi. These problems happen with these sorts of cameras, and there's a process in the bill for letting it play out. But once lawmakers in this state start getting angry phone calls from constituents saying, I got a ticket, hey, maybe they even were the ones speeding. But if they start getting those angry phone calls, does that stop progress if this pilot program goes forward?
I think those situations are few and far between, and I think they're easy to resolve, you know, in the bill. And I think if you look at the national trend for the concern about red light cameras, the national trend, red light cameras kind of had their day and it's over. The trend nationally is their cities and towns are pulling them out. In favor of more targeted, do we put them on a school bus stop arm? Do we put them in a construction zone? As a deterrent to protect not just the workers, but the motoring public, because there's more fatalities among motorists in these work zones than there are among the workers.
That's right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, should Indiana put cameras in highway construction zones that are used to give motorists speeding tickets? A yes or B no. Last week, we asked you if former Democratic Senate candidate Tom McDermott was correct that only moderate Democrats can win statewide in Indiana. 79% of you say yes, just 21% of you say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation spent more than $125 million in 2022 alone to buy land in Boone County for a proposed advanced manufacturing district. That's according to reporting from the Indianapolis Business Journal and the Indiana Capital Chronicle. The IEDC has secured about 9,000 acres over time for the LEAP, Lebanon Innovation and Research District. And according to the IBJ report, the agency paid more than six times the market value for the land it bought last year, most of it agricultural parcels. The IEDC doesn't want to stop its efforts, either in Boone County or elsewhere. It's requesting a land acquisition fund in the new state budget to the tune of $150 million. Nikki, is this a fiscally responsible use of public dollars?
I mean, it's philosophical, right? I mean, this is a new thing we're trying where the state is going to be on the hook, put out all this money to build this, build it and they will come, right? We're going to see if we build it and they will come. I do want to say a couple things about it. First of all, they've only bought about 1,500 acres so far. The rest are optioned. So this is going to get real expensive. And we don't know anything yet about are the companies going to buy it back? Are they going to pay the same rate? We have no idea on that. We're just shelling out taxpayer money. And secondly, obviously some of these entities or some of these purchases show huge fluctuations in, you know, like the market value of something might have been, you know, $150,000 and they paid $1 million. But the issue is Indiana uses something called market value in use. And so that means if you have a house, it's getting compared to other houses. Same with like unused farm ground or used farm ground. But we don't translate into when we're shifting the use to a
right,
completely
different. So they're buying farmland that's
going to
be used for advanced manufacturing, which is more expensive. So they might be able to sell it for more than they bought it, or at least more than it was worth when they bought it. But
it's a little more difficult to make the direct comparison on use because it's no longer going to be used as a residence. It's no longer going to be used as farmland.
Is the biggest issue here, if there is an issue, that, you know, Nikki just pointed out, we're trying something new. There could be and seems to be a lot of merit to the idea, but we're not going halfway. Well, this is not a pilot project we're trying this out on. This is a lot of money being spent on something that we hope might happen, right?
It is. Although remember the quaint old days where this argument would have centered on eminent domain? I mean, and that would have been litigated when the old way of government operation. When you talk about modern manufacturing, advanced manufacturing, and the stakes being what they are and the timetables for development being what they are, if you want to get into this game, it seems to me you do have to go whole hog. You can't just say, hey, we might do this, we might not. And really, yes, there is certainly a philosophical debate to be had here, but you can go back in the past 20, 30, 40 years at state level and federal level where government, sometimes it takes government to take on the risk to do something significant because there's just not the early incentive for companies to do it.
Is this a gamble? And is it a gamble worth taking?
It's the next evolution. Think about 15 years ago. We were talking about how do we attract businesses here, property tax credits, replacement, forgiveness, some other kind of accommodation. It's a highly competitive environment. We're competing with a lot of other places, and this is a new tool to try to do that.
I mentioned in the piece, they've been doing this for a while. There's more probably to come in that area, but this is not the only part of the state they want to do this in, and it's not the only amount of money they want to do it with. This is part of the new state budget, presumably, and we'll see what the Senate has to say and what the final product has to say. But is this the future for Indiana, at least in the near term?
It may be, and they're going to have to answer to it. I mean, we may not know right now if it's going to pay off. And if it doesn't, there's a huge price tag at a time when there are a lot of other budget asks that are coming before the legislature and a lot of other entities. So I do think it's a gamble and it's yet to be seen. It's taxpayer dollars. It's the IEDC, which since its inception has been able to play by some different rules when it comes to transparency. So I think folks are watching them and it's yet to be seen.
I want to ask one more quick question, which is, are you surprised that House Republicans gave them everything they wanted for that land fund?
Yeah, well, and honestly, we don't know what they want. And I mean, think about it. For 1,500 acres, that's $125 million. Like, this project, when you add in all the acreage of 9,000 acres, plus how they're going to deal with water, which is a whole other discussion, this could be a billion-dollar outlay by the end. But we don't know it because they're sort of piecemealing the information or the plan.
And it could all pay off.
It could.
It could all pay off.
It could
Absolutely.
All pay off. But it also might not. All right, finally, the NCAA tournaments have begun. Indiana and Purdue have both men's and women's teams in the tourneys, although the Purdue women's team lost yesterday, with the Purdue men and IU women both securing number one seeds. Notre Dame women are looking to make a deep run as a three seed, although Olivia Miles' injury may hurt that chance. Mike O'Brien, which Indiana-based team makes the deepest run in a tournament this year?
It's got to be the Hoosier women, right? Well, we got to bet on them.
Yeah, I think so.
Literally, bet that.
Literally, bet on them.
Mama Schrock is a Boilermaker. I could never go on television and say either otherwise. I do value my life, so we'll go with
so
Purdue.
So it's the Purdue men for Elise Schrock. Who makes the deepest
draw? I'll go with the Purdue men.
The Purdue men.
I'm confused by the question, because if the IU men and the IU women both win the national championships in their respective group, who do we say who went
then
further?
I think America. IU, America.
All right, that's my pick then. I have no objectivity.
We asked Todd Houston who he has in his brackets, and he pointed out, like, unlike the governor, he's not doing IU in one and Purdue in the other, which of course means that Todd Houston does not have higher political office ambitions in the state of Indiana. I think the IU women are going to go almost all the way, but on the women's side, I don't see South Carolina losing to anyone this year. That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelist. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.